I introduced this idea of a sharing meter, which you can't see because it's not allowing me to present, but I'll kind of try to get you to read it here. Just reflecting on how ready you are to share your personal biases. So in a minute, we're going to get into pairs. And if you took the Harvard Bias Test, that can be some of the information you choose to share. You don't have to share, you don't even have to say what bias tests you took if you don't want to. You can just say what you noticed. If you didn't take the test, that's fine. Maybe sharing personal experience of noticing bias in yourself. It's more of a little bit of an opening and sharing around what you've noticed about yourself related to bias. Okay. And this is like the meter, the comfort level in sharing. Let's see if it's going to let me. No. Okay. So number one is I'm not comfortable looking at or sharing any of my biases or feelings around what's arising for me. So when you get with your partner, like we did last night, share what your comfort level is with sharing. Number two is I'm not comfortable sharing my biases, but I'm okay to personally look at them, and I'm not comfortable sharing my feelings around what's arising. So if you're one or a two, it's fine, and it might not be a long conversation with your partner, and that's okay. Three, I'm not comfortable sharing my biases, but I am comfortable sharing my feelings around what is arising for me. So you might just be able to share what's coming up for you, but not share what your bias is. Four, I'm comfortable sharing some aspects of my biases and my feelings around what's arising. And number five is ready to share everything. Sort of evaluate what number you are for sharing, and then also how you are about hearing someone else's biases. If you're a number one for yourself for sharing, it might be very triggering to be a partner with someone who's a number five and ready to share everything. That might feel uncomfortable. So,
because it's also about listening.
Yeah, because it's about listening to what the person is saying. So we're going to pair up, and I don't have a great way to pair up because I don't want someone who is maybe not as comfortable, might not be comfortable sharing, that they're not comfortable. Right, like in the whole group.
Right. Oh, geez.
So what I would like you to do is get up and mill around and find a partner that you feel that you both would feel comfortable talking to each other at whatever level you're at. Does that make sense?
So is it okay to maybe like just check in with people?
Yes, check. That's the idea. Like checking in with people, like how comfortable are you sharing? I'm this number for listening or whatever. Emma?
Will you just say again what exactly we will be sharing about?
Oh, so if you took the Harvard Bias Test, that would be information to share. If you did not, then I would maybe think of like what biases you have seen in yourself. And if you haven't any yet, that's okay. We just need to look harder because we all have them, unfortunately. So I guess it depends on what you have to share. Does that make sense?
And the more open you are, closer to five you are?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
So could you read three and four? Because I can't read.
Three is I'm not comfortable sharing my biases, but I'm okay sharing my feelings around what's arising. Four is you're comfortable sharing some aspects of my bias and your feelings.
Okay.
All right. So go ahead and find a partner. Wrap up your notes. And I think we'll just debrief this as a whole. So do I have somebody who'd like to respond to this first question about internal power versus power over? Thoughts that somebody wants to share on that? Emma?
I was thinking about
about power, like, in terms of, like, it expresses, like, the capacity that we have to enact some change. So, like, the power that we have within ourselves is that, like, we may have, like, agency in terms of how we, like, relate to our thoughts or the kinds of choices that we make in our life, and that might, like, affect how we hold, or, like, how I would hold myself. And then, like, power over feels like it's more, like, connected to bias because it's relational. So it's like, yeah, dependent on like cultural narratives, I guess, around like attributes that collectively are like regarded as like superior, like whiteness or like ability. Yeah. I don't know, like, power over feels, like, wrong in a way. I don't know, or, like, manipulative, because it is dependent on a lot of injustice.
Anyone else for this one? Does power over always have to be negative? Is there a situation where a person has power over someone else, but it's not negative?
Yeah.
Like, what do you think? Like, an example? Do you have one, Jenny?
Well, as a parent, I think, you know, safety and hopefully health safety.
Right.
That's a power that's positive. And any time someone's available for others who are looking for a role model, and that person, that role model, is willing to teach and whatever, you know, by modeling or conveying information, there's a certain amount of power there. If it's beneficial, I think that person in power has humility. Compassion as well.
And it's, I think it's maybe how the person in power, how they use the power.
Mm-hmm.
If it's to take advantage, or if it's to help and support and provide safety or provide something.
I have a quick question about, so I was writing down things like that, there's a distinction when there's actual abuse.
Right.
So some of these things that I thought of, where it could be negative, and you could actually, if you're not the power person, you could work with that. Like, what could you do in where you have a powerful boss and you're trying to live and work with that? But if there's actual abuse,
yeah,
physical abuse of some kind.
That's a different ballgame, yeah, for sure. Jake, did you have something?
So, essentially, we have choices. We can actually give somebody else power over us if that relationship is healthy, like a mentor-mentee, or a parent-child, or even a work environment, military environment. But if somebody is abusive, we can make a choice, I can make a choice to say, I'm out of here. And so that's empowering to have that power and to know you have that power.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't have to take it.
Right. Yeah. Carolyn and Terry?
I think it's really nuanced when we start to talk about it depends on how power is used, because this goes back to perspectives. Because I witness a lot of caregivers of their parents. I think I do this with my own in-laws, I think, a little bit. As their physical and economic power fades, the next generation, for example, might come forward, and there, even if there's a respect there, there is also a power. And there's this, I don't think there's one point, but there's like the tide coming in, and eventually, you know, you get above the low tide mark. And too much autonomy in the name of taking care of somebody ends up getting, the risk is that too much autonomy is suppressed. And I was just thinking, I was with a kid whose grandmother recently died, and he was talking about how his grandmother would fire her different children, kind of tongue-in-cheek, but it was her way of dealing with her frustration, because at 99 and a half, she was like, I want some ice cream. And they would say, yeah, but you had some this afternoon. You shouldn't be eating that now. And in some level, they were right, and they were the most loving kids. They loved her to pieces. But the fact that they couldn't step away from their role a little, I don't know what to make of that situation, because they were doing this all with pureness of heart, but they used their power in a way that was frustrating this person who was powerless to get up and leave.
That's an interesting context.
Mm-hmm.
Carrie?
Or even to get up and get her own ice cream.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that because I'm a privileged white woman with income and a car and a home, I have choices. But if you're in a situation where you don't have those privileges, then you're more likely, I think, to be in a situation where you can't make a choice. Like, you can't just resign and
right.
go away.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really, I think, for me, I think that I like to use my privilege to help people that don't have the privileges, because and they have less power to stand up.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that too in a minute. Let's go on to number two. How can mindfulness support your own internal power? Any thoughts here?
I have a thought.
Yeah.
This was. I'm just going to read what I wrote. I find that mindfulness supports my internal power by giving me a tool for like recognizing and disentangling from thoughts or emotions that are actually threatening or diminishing my internal power. And so like that might look like self-doubt or something. And so being able to notice like what is happening in my body and whether it's like, you know, sensation in my stomach or noticing that I'm getting nervous or I'm feeling like I'm shrinking a little, it helps me become, you know, it's helped me be aware of that so that I can name it for what it is. And, you know, that for me might go something like, oh, I'm feeling some anxiety around this. Okay, that's my body responding. That's my body with energy to deal with the unknown. That energy can be used for courage because I can tell myself a different story in that moment, you know? And so that's kind of the practice that I've been in with that. And but it really has supported me in reestablishing internal power. Because sometimes when there's external power that is that is not healthy, it affecting someone, impacting someone, it can really minimize that person's internal power, and it makes it hard to sometimes decide just not to be there, right? You can't, it's not so easy to disengage sometimes. So that for me has been like a rebuilding. That's part of the way that I've done that is through my practice. Yeah. Thanks.
Can you say that part in the course you said recognizing and detangling from experiences?
Yeah, I think I wrote that down. So recognizing and disentangling from thoughts and emotions that can threaten to diminish my internal power. Threaten to or do. Right. Yeah.
And then to honor time, I'm going to move on to the last question because I have a couple more things to do. Why is it important to talk about power in the context of being a mindfulness teacher?
I think it's just important to recognize that as the teacher, there's an implicit power dynamic that goes on, and so it's an opportunity to cultivate humility and loving kindness towards the people you're working with, and not be overly impressed yourself with yourself.
That's a nice way to say it.
But people do look up to the teacher.
Any other thoughts on this one?
Just like the actual people that are practicing mindfulness to be aware of thoughts related to biases, strengths, weaknesses within, and then to sort of maybe challenge some of our, what we thought was accurate, and maybe it can help us be more loving and kind and compassionate to different people.
I was just thinking about I feel like sometimes like having power like in a dynamic can sort of like insulate a person from maybe having to be vulnerable, like if I'm like holding space for someone like in a mindfulness context and I like have those tools and skills, I feel like as a mindfulness facilitator, like reciprocating, like to some extent, the vulnerability and like practicing with people, you know, instead of like using the power to shy away from vulnerability. Yeah, because I notice that sometimes when I talk to friends who don't have like might not communicate with like the kinds of like practices that I try to communicate with, like I notice that I can kind of I don't know, remove myself a little bit from the interaction, like pathologize or something. I don't know. So it's like, yeah, as a mindfulness instructor, not pathologizing people or just being being with them.
Okay, one more.
I think it's important to share with people that we live a daily narrative and what we should, what we expect and how we react and respond almost the same way to the same things that are happening. And if we realize that there's more to who we are than our narrative and go below it, that's when we can find the power, personal power. You know, it's like being having a beginner's mind to know that you can address this thing differently with more wisdom than you might have 20 years ago or 10 years ago.
Yeah. Okay, so I created this little quiz based on societal power. And I think it's important that we're all, Terry brought in, like, aware of our own power in the society. And if you haven't been aware of that, you know, walking into a room and realizing that you're comparing yourself to others. If you haven't experienced that, it might be because you're often in situations where you feel comfortable. Like, there's not many places on Cape Cod that I go to that I don't feel comfortable walking in. I feel comfortable walking into the grocery store, into the post office, into the library, into wherever. There are some people who don't feel comfortable walking into those spaces on Cape Cod. And so I might take that for granted because of where I am in the societal hierarchy of power. So everybody starts with 0 points, and you're either going to add or subtract points. So we're going to kind of go fast. And so just put plus or minus for you. So starting at 0, add 1 if you're a man. Subtract 1 if you're female.
Subtract 1, you said?
Yeah. And this is based on societal hierarchy in the United States. And we all just talked about this outside. Add 1 if you're white. Subtract 2 if you're black, African American, or indigenous. Add 1 if you're heterosexual. Subtract 1 if you are homosexual. Subtract 2 if you are consider yourself non-binary, transgender, asexual, pansexual, and maybe anything else I might have missed. Subtract 2 if you grew up under the poverty line, like if you received public assistance. Add 1 if you grew up upper class. Subtract 1 if your household currently earns $35,000 or less. And add 1 if your household currently earns more than $200,000. So if you notice you're not in one of those categories, that just means you stay. That $200,000 is actually the number in Massachusetts. $199,000 is considered upper class as of a few days ago. Subtract 1 if you did not get a high school diploma or GED. Add 1 if you have a bachelor's or associate's degree. Add 2 if you have a master's or PhD. And add 1 for every parent who has a college degree, including step-parents if you were raised by them.
Can you just repeat that last one?
Add 1 for every parent who has a college degree.
So would you include yourself in that?
No, your parents. For every, your personal parents. Subtract 1 for every parent who did not graduate from high school or get a GED. Add 1 if you're able-bodied. Add 1 if you identify as having a physical or mental disability.
Add
1. Oh, sorry. No, that should be subtract. I need to change my notes. Subtract 1 if any of your parents had a physical or mental disability. And subtract 1 if any of your parents had issues with addiction. So total up your wherever you are, and we're no need for us to compare numbers here. But the higher your number, the more societal power you have in our culture. And as a teacher, being aware of that's important. And when we do have societal power, we can choose what to do with that. And we have to be careful of not, sometimes it backfires because we overcompensate. And I have a couple of great videos, but we only have time to show one. This is from a movie. Oh, I hope it plays. It might have disconnected from my thing.
I hit the power button on the video.
No, that's connected. This is here. Oh, it's still connected. It's connected to my phone, you know, so it's like not super. What I might just do is, I wanted to show the other one, not this one. Let's see if this one's it. Oh, here it is. So this is from the movie You People, if anybody's ever seen it. Jonah Hill, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Eddie Murphy's in it. It's very good, and it just points out some really cringy things that people do, thinking that they're being helpful and thinking that they're being an ally, and it's... Anyhow, here we go. So the son of Julia Louis-Dreyfus is marrying this woman.
That's attitude.
That's my problem.
I'm so sorry. Just so you know, I come here all the time. I can't believe what you have to go through. Hang on just a second.
No, Michelle, I believe
I got it.
I guess you should. Okay, you are.
Hi. Oh, hi. As the future mother-in-law of an African-American woman in America, I am appalled and I am disgusted to have witnessed the racism that I just witnessed. You know exactly what I'm talking about.
So that's, you know, it's like overcompensating, trying. Some of you have, there's another great Office one. We don't have time to watch it one, but I will play it. It is the break, but if you want to go take a break, I will play it during the break. Only to say that, you know, we just have to be aware of these dynamics and be careful we're not becoming a savior for a group that is, you know, I'm having a hard time finding my words of what I'm trying to say.
It doesn't need a savior, yeah.
Yeah,
right.
Not being the savior. So, yeah, important things to know when you're leading a group and you might not know what everybody's arriving with. And so just to be open and, yeah.
I was just thinking, like, with not being a savior, like, not making that, like, enormous assumption that she just made, like, about mm-hmm. how that experience was landing for.
Exactly. Which is exactly what this one is. So we are going to take a break. We're going to come back at 2:45.
Okay.
In here.
Right.
Yep. And if you want to watch this video, feel free.
I'll leave it on.
Zero alcohol,
zero sugar. Try now. While we are waiting for our special guest, July, I want you all to take a look at a few of the many, many disabled icons who have contributed so much to our society.
Quick question.
Yeah.
Why is Tom Hanks on the wall twice?
Good question. Forrest Gump? Can we challenged? Philadelphia, AIDS.
I think that's for Big.
I don't think so, no.
Yeah, he's dancing on a piano with Robert Loggia.
He grew into a man overnight. A rare disability, still works. A crossword puzzle, Stanley? Seriously, are you learning nothing here?
I'm learning nothing.
Okay.
Uncle Scott, I'm looking for Michael Scott.
Yes, right in here.
Good.
Come on in. This, ladies and gentlemen, is our special guest.
Sorry I'm late. Somebody parked in the handicap parking space.
Hey, everyone. I'm Billy Merchant. You may have seen me around here before. I'm the properties manager of this office park.
You are so brave. You are so brave.
Thank you. Actually, I've been meaning to come by here for a long time.
But it's hard for you, right? Because you're in a wheelchair.
No, I just have a lot of properties to manage.
Let me ask you something. How long does it take for you to do something simple every day, like brush your teeth in the morning?
I don't know, like 30 seconds?
Oh, my God. That's three times as long as it takes me. How did you get in your wheelchair?
This morning? Just like every other morning, just climbed on in.
Hey, not funny.
Hey, relax. Just joking around here.
Well, that's good. He still has a sense of humor.
Listen, I've actually used a chair since I was 4 years old. I don't really notice it anymore.
Well, they do. They notice it, don't you? You notice it. It's the first thing you saw when he rolled in here, isn't it?
I'm going to clamp Michael's face in the George Foreman grill.
So, there are just a couple things I want to remind everybody of.
Okay.
First is parking. You can't block the freight entrance with your car, even if your blinkers are on. Does anybody have any questions? Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Ignore him. You know what? We're not that different, you and I. When I plant my foot into a non-stick drum.
You know what, Michael?
Yeah.
Let me stop you right there.
Okay.
And leave.
So, the office does a great job of pointing out social ineptitude. Michael Scott is like the epitome of saying the wrong thing all of the time.
So have you seen
the on YouTube? Yeah, it's on YouTube. Oh, the sexual harassment one. It's really funny. Okay, thanks. That was a quick ending to that whole long discussion. Oh.